Factory Podcast from Bright & Associates, presented by Jim Bright.
Hello and welcome to The Factory. My name is Jim Bright. The Factory Podcast for this edition is a very special one. It features an interview with Professor John Krumholz from the School of Education at Stanford University. I found myself in San Francisco in June of this year, 2007. So I hopped on a Caltrain and took the one-hour journey down to Palo Alto. My purpose was to interview John Krumholz about his very significant contribution to the field of career development and to talk to him about his learning theory of career development and his happenstance learning theory in particular, which looks at unplanned and chance events. I have to express a certain bias here in that the theory that I've been developing with Robert Pryor, the chaos theory of careers, has been influenced by Professor Krumholz's work, and in particular the notion of chance events having a significant influence on people's careers is something that chimes with my own work. So without further ado, let's go to June the 29th. It wasn't June the 30th, as we say in the interview, that was me misleading everybody, but June the 29th, 2007, Stanford University and Professor John Krumholz. So it's the 30th today, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, the 30th of June, 2007.
30th of June, 2007, Stanford University, School of Education with Professor John Krumholz. He very kindly agreed to be interviewed for the Factory Podcast. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
John, really what I'd like to do is to talk about some of the key contributions that you've made in the field of career counselling and some of the practical sorts of work that you have done and continuing to do in the field. And I thought we might start off by reviewing some of the key sort of theoretical developments that you've made in the field. And when I think of those, I think of three major strands. And the first of those is the social learning theory of career development. Related to that is the learning theory of career counselling. And the third one is the happenstance learning theory. And perhaps you'd like to tell us a little bit about how different to other things in the field.
Well, let me tell you a story. I have a neurosis, and my neurosis is that I have never been able to figure out what I should be when I grow up. And when I was a child, my parents used to ask me, "Well, John, what are you going to be when you grow up?" And I would always, and after a while I got to think there must be something wrong with me because I don't know what I'm supposed to be when I grow up. And I can even remember one time asking my 12-year-old friend Leo, when we were both 12 years old, "Leo, do you know what you want to be when you grow up?" And what do you want to be? He said, "I want to be an architect." And I said, "How did you find that out?" And he said, "I've always known that." And it made me feel all the more inferior because I've never always known anything about what I want to be. And so here he is always having known this, and I've never known what. I thought there must be something wrong with me. And so eventually it sort of led me into the field of career counseling because I thought, I've heard that career counselors have some kind of a tool that they can administer, and it will tell you what you should be when you grow up. And so what I will do is to administer that and tell myself what I should be. So that is how I got into this field of building theory about career development. And the three theories that you listed are actually all the same theory. It's all one big theory, and I could try to summarize it for you in maybe one or two. Basically, you never know what you should be when you grow up. And you should not even try to find out because there is no way to know. The future is unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And we're making plans, but the mistake is to think that if you make a plan, you have to stick to it. So what I'm saying, well, plan to your heart's content if you want, but don't think you've got to stick to it because there are so many unexpected events in life that change the course of your path that you should be open to those opportunities. and be willing to change at a moment's notice if it seems advantageous to you.
I'm interested that you developed this theory at a time when, train and factor theories were absolutely dominant. The work of people, those sorts of approaches seem to be absolutely dominating the field at the time. So, going off in this direction, that was possibly a brave thing to do, or you obviously feel passionately about this from an early age. Why go down that learning theory, unplanned events kind of path rather than stuff?
Well, I started off with the trait factor stuff. I mean, because that was 100% of what career counseling was to begin with. And this is what Frank Parsons wrote his book about in 1909. Mm. And we've been following the same model ever since. The perfect match. That's it. And it seems so simple and so logical that, you know, it just sort of natural followed. Well, yeah, that's the way it ought to be done. I don't know exactly how it got started, but one key event was I was doing some research beliefs, and it was at a time when I had a sabbatical leave, and I was in England, and interviewing people who had in various occupations about what they were doing. And I remember one particular guy I was interviewing. He was a 25-year-old. How did you get to be a chemist? He said, well, you know, here in England, we have to declare our occupational goals when we're 15 years old. And so I didn't know what I wanted to be. But one of my buddies told me that chemists made a lot of money. And so I just wrote down chemist on the form. So then when I went to high school, I was at chemistry classes. And then I went to college, and I was channeled into more chemistry classes. And then I went to graduate school, and I took more chemistry. And then I graduated with a PhD, and I got a job in a chemical factory as a chemist. And he said, I hate it. I hate it. And I said, well, then why don't you change your plan? Why don't you do something else? Oh, he said, I can't do that. I have too much invested in chemistry. I can't change now. See? And so I was thinking to myself, well, you are then going to spend the rest of your life doing something that you hate, because you've already spent 10 years doing something you hate. Mm. And that just seemed to be so ridiculous to me. Mm. So ridiculous. Started me thinking, you know, does it make sense to declare your goal at an early age and then to stick to it for the rest of your life? Just because you declared it at an early age. No, that doesn't make sense. See? That sort of started me thinking about, so this is a belief that actually, on the career beliefs inventory, which is published, there are some items about, have you decided what you want to be when you grow up, basically is the question. And if a person says, yes, I know what I want to be when I grow up, we put that on the troubled side. Mm. See? And the people say, no, I'm not certain yet. We say, that's good that you that you haven't decided. Get away from the notion of making plans that they're going to stick with forever.
Mm. It strikes me that there's this constant temptation to fall into a sort of a static view of yourself and occupation and careers. And it can be almost exacerbated by some of these notions of matching or fitting people in. Almost as though I've got it out of the way quickly.
Yes.
Before I'm 20.
Yes.
And then I know who I am, and I'll just be that person, and that's it.
That's exactly the kind of thinking that causes big trouble.
Mm.
See, and a more productive kind of thinking is, deciding what I want to be when I grow up is really a dumb thing to ask, and that would be a fun thing to try next. Mm. Let's think about trying things out. And doing them as long as they are satisfying and fun and meaningful. But always keeping your eyes open for other alternatives. Because something else might be even more fun or more interesting or more satisfying.
And I think that has been there. It's been made in all sorts of interesting areas. I mean, you've got people like Steinbeck talking about the best laid plans of mice and men. Mm-hmm. You've got Dwight Eisenhower talking about in battle plans are useless, but planning is indispensable. That mm-hmm. kind of notion. You've got to keep reinventing plans. Or even John Lennon saying life is what happens when you're busy making other plans.
Yes.
Yet we still in careers fall back on, and many of the people who come to see us have the expectation that we're going to fit them in somewhere, and that's going to be the end of the story.
Yeah, they expect that we will tell them what they are supposed to be.
So part of the theory then is that things are continually changing, and therefore it's plain dumb to take a changing individual and a changing world.
Exactly. Things are changing the world. There are occupations being created that are never existed 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Old occupations are disappearing. Occupations that used to be plentiful are very in short supply. And not only is the world changed, but each individual is developing new interests. And what you were interested in last year may not be what you really enjoy this year. Mm-hmm. And so why tie yourself down into a plan that makes you stuck? Nonsense.
And I guess if you haven't been exposed to it, you don't know whether you're interested in it or not.
Exactly. You can't know until you've tried it. Mm. See, this is the other thing. By asking people to declare their occupational goal when they haven't done anything. How could you know? There's no way to know.
Well, I suppose the counter to that is, and I remember a participant in a training course recently saying to me, but what time?
Well, see, I would say there's no such thing as a waste of time. Every minute that has gone by is a minute that will never reappear. The way to look at it, I think, is that every minute that goes by is a minute that you ought to be alert to learning something. So I'm learning something just by talking to you, this mess, spending together right now talking. It's not wasted time for me. It's valuable time because I am learning things from you. And I don't know if you're learning anything from me or not, but that's your problem.
Okay, so we're talking about a changing situation. We're talking about a situation where you're continually learning, or you should be on the lookout for doing that. Happenstance learning theory. How does that fit into this?
Well, see, the happenstance learning theory is sort of a way of summarizing just a lot of what I have just said. Mm-hmm. That we are, as we go through life, we encounter, and we do things, we encounter all kinds of unexpected events. These unexpected events can present opportunities if we are alert to the possible opportunities that are in them. And if we see it in a certain way, we might find something that we would prefer doing. So then we ought to start doing it and trying it out, which might present other opportunities. See? And you're partly not very good, not very satisfying. See, and the happenstance learning theory says, that's great. You should make mistakes. You should try things even if they are not going to work out. You should expect to fail because you learn from failing. It's okay to fail. It's okay to make mistakes.
So what happens mysteriously between about the age of I flatten our faces, laugh about it, and get up and try to walk again?
Yes.
And we realize intuitively that that making mistakes is a really powerful way of learning.
Yes.
And then we go through an educational system that beats errors out of us to the point that we daren't make a mistake or look stupid or be left behind.
Jim, I'm so glad that you raised that issue because I think this is one of the biggest flaws in our educational system is that we teach people that they are supposed to be perfect. And part of it is this whole notion that education is a competitive game and that you're supposed to win at this game of you're supposed to get high scores on all these tests, and we have zillions and zillions of tests and quizzes and papers and things that are graded and judged and criticized, and it makes education no fun. Mm-hmm. We teach people love learning.
Absolutely.
See? And we've got education on its ear, doing all the wrong stuff. See? And when I teach my classes, I have stopped. I no longer give lectures. I no longer give final examinations. Mm-hmm. I no longer give midterm examinations. But I do get students involved in a whole that force them to learn. Mm-hmm. But I tell them, I don't care who knows the most at the end of the course. Mm-hmm. What I care about is, have you been trying your best to learn while you're here? Mm-hmm. See? So I want you to be engaged actively, and all of these are valuable. Even though I won't be able to measure how much you've improved, I want you to be trying to improve. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I mean, indeed, you see that among students. One of the things I was obliged to go through many years ago when I started in academia, a course in how to teach in higher education.
Okay.
Which was one of the most dispiriting experiences of my life, mm-hmm. where I was told bluntly that students are assessment focused.
Wait, students are what?
Assessment-focused.
Oh, assessment-focused, yes.
So everything should start from the assessment and then work backwards.
Yes.
And then you might consider putting in some content. Yes. So I thought this was the most important aspect of the whole thing. Get the assessment right, and that's higher education.
Yes. But it assumes that we can assess what people should learn accurately, and that therefore, and the ones that score highest on this assessment instrument are the ones that then should get more education, and the rest are sort of relegated to the dump heap.
And I guess in a way, it's another form of imposing a closed system, isn't it, by saying, you know, there is a right answer.
Yes.
To this, I think it was again one of my heroes, Peter Ustinov, was saying when he was in class, and he has a Russian descent. And the teacher said, name of a Russian composer. And he said, Rimsky-Korsakov. And the person said, wrong, Tchaikovsky. this notion of there is a right answer or approach.
Well, let me tell you a story. When I was in ninth grade, I had an English teacher who gave us an assignment of, I want you to write an essay on the topic of... should everyone go to college? And you can take either side of the argument. You can say, yes, everyone should go to college, or no, everyone need not. You can decide either way, and then you write an essay to defend your point of view. Okay, so at that moment of my life, I decided everyone should go to college, and so I wrote the essay on it, and I got back an A grade on this paper. The little girl, Shirley Williams, was sitting right behind me in my class, and she got back her paper with a great big red F on it for failure, and the teacher's comment, nonsense, everyone should go to college.
I see, there's one answer. Yes.
There's only one answer. There was only one answer that was correct, and it was graded rigorously.
So, do here is, and again, this comes out of a lot of mainstream education, mainstream science, and with the train factor approach, is in a sense we're talking about errors, and we're saying that life is errors. Life is all full of errors, mm-hmm. and it's how you learn from those things, mm-hmm. which is the critical adaptive state.
Right.
Error in science. Error is the sort of black sheep uncle who we don't talk about, and we try to exclude on all occasions. So we can get the purity of the signal. Yet here we are sitting here saying errors are good.
Well, see, I'm not sure that all of science is. I think that errors are inevitable. And in statistics, we have what's called the error term that we use, and we have probabilistic thinking. You know, that our conclusion we are 95% certain that. That this conclusion is correct, but there's 5% chance that we're wrong. Mm. See, so there is time to still operate, even though there is this error. So I think there is some tolerance for it, and also the whole notion of science is that we're trying to disprove hypotheses. So we put up a hypothesis and we try to test it to see. To collect evidence whether we are making a mistake by believing this. Mm. So in a sense, the whole, if you look at science the way it's supposed to be done, we use errors as a method of finding more accurate formulations.
Lost in the hubris of the 95%.
There's some tendency also to think that anything a scientist concludes is correct. When actually even the scientific findings, like, you know, does taking aspirin reduce the frequency of heart attacks? Well, you know, maybe it does, but you know, there's some probability that maybe it was wrong. And besides, how was that study done? Who paid for that study? I found out that the Bayer aspirin people actually financed that study. And oh, really? Oh, that makes me think twice about whether it's correct or not.
And I think there's also that issue in that with the particular. And we may be dealing with somebody who has experienced one of those 5% events rather than the 95% event.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And for that individual, it's not a trivial matter. This could be absolutely life-transforming.
For that particular individual.
Mm.
That's right.
And that's what we have to confront. So there's no point kind of saying, well, you know, 95% of people had no bad reaction to this or whatever it may be. Very helpful for the individual. Well,
for the individual who suffers from the bad reaction, that's right.
And I think the notion there with the happenstance learning theory is that there's a lot more of these unplanned events around than perhaps other theories would give credit for. Theories that tend to emphasize stability and order.
Well, I agree with you. Because there are, I mean, every day there are unplanned events that occur. I mean, the very fact that you and I are talking here today is something that I didn't anticipate yesterday. At least not in the morning yesterday.
Yes.
Until I got your email. But when I got your email, I thought, hey, this would be this in the time that you suggested. It just happened to fit my schedule perfectly. Mm-hmm. That was a happenstance event. And so I had an appointment before this. I have another appointment coming up immediately afterwards. It just happened to be perfect, and so you and I get to talk.
Uncharacteristically got on the right train.
That's right. That's right.
It
might not have happened.
Yes.
Or if the train had been slowed down, or all kinds of things. You just never know what might happen. But you have to be alert to opportunities that might arise and make the best of them.
Yep, absolutely. You published a paper with a To Die For title, that serendipity is not serendipitous, in 98. And then you followed it up with the book you wrote with Al Levin, which is Luck is No Accident.
Yes.
Essentially there you're saying, capitalize, look for unplanned.
Luck is no accident. It is actually, I would say, create your own unplanned events.
Mm-hmm.
Be alert to what might come from them, and seize opportunities that you detect. So it's not just waiting for luck. That would be a misunderstanding. You don't wait.
Yeah.
You have to go out there and do things that create these unexpected events. And some of the unexpected events that you create may not be very happy. They might be mistakes. Well, okay, you learn from that. So that's okay. But you've got to be trying satisfactorily.
I think it's the way people think about chance events. Now, I had a master's student in Australia, and we haven't yet published this, who divided up chance events into events which had a high significance on your life, or a low significance in terms of their impact, and also in terms of control, whether you had a high degree of control in the aftermath of the event. And the classic example of a high impact with low control would be a motor vehicle accident where you're seriously injured because it changes your life and you've got no control over what happens afterwards. You're obliged to go through a long period of rehabilitation. But other events like, I don't know, you bump into somebody at the party who says, come in on Monday and we'll have a chat about a position, scenarios, and we show them to people, little stories. And then an hour later, we ask them to recall the stories and we put in different ones, high control, low control, and so forth. And the best recalled ones were the high impact and low control, like the motor vehicle accidents.
Mm.
And that is the thing, that when people think of chance events, they think of events where they have no control over the aftermath. Mm. It's like the motor vehicle accident stick.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think we know that most events are not like that. We have high degrees of control over the unplanned events.
Well, that's true. But, you know, it's interesting that people tend to remember your high impact was also a negative event. See, people tend to remember that have a post-traumatic stress disorder, and they can't forget the trauma that they went through on the battlefield. It's just they have nightmares about it forever afterwards. So there is somehow we are wired in such a way that these life-threatening events more vividly than something pleasant. But you know, maybe we could imagine some kind of a really very fantastic, pleasant event, like falling in love with the girl that you abandoned her and all that kind of stuff. I mean, if you try to remember some really pleasant events, but it would have a high impact, that might be. That might be the kind of thing you want to put into this study.
Yeah.
not just have negative events as high impact.
Yeah, I think it's the notion of the control was particular. I think it's a particular.
Yes, the control.
That sort of sense of, it's almost a helplessness sort of sense of, oh, well, you know, chance events are these mysterious things, and when they come along, well, you know, I'll just deal with it and we'll get away and we'll try and hide away from as many of these events as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You see people living their lives like that, sort of. Whether it's sort of building, you know, literally building walls around their house going. And I think you're saying, well, let's create a bit of uncertainty.
Well, yeah, and I would like to encourage the notion of celebrating the uncertainty rather than being afraid of it.
Mm.
That if we could just kind of think of, some people say, I'm not sure what I'm going to be doing tomorrow. Well, gosh, that's wonderful. Tomorrow's going to be a completely new adventure for you.
And people really want uncertainty. I think, you know, maybe we should do the study where we stand outside a cinema and tell people what happens at the end.
That's good.
And count how many people go in.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, if you know the outcome.
I sometimes ask that in class and say, look, you know, if I had impeccable connections, so I know exactly on which day each one of you will die in Ohio, would you like me to tell you?
Uh-huh.
And most people, 90% or more, will say no, they don't want to know. So when it comes down to that ultimate kind of question, people aren't interested. They don't. They want that uncertainty. Yet in the short term, they want to know what they're doing on Monday.
Well, of course, what I would like to know is, I don't want to know when I'm going to die, I want to know where I'm going to die. Because then I would never go there.
Yes, that raises a whole range of interesting questions, which I don't think we'll have time for today. Learning is, in a sense, related to career information, and information, we need to have that. And you did a lovely study a few years ago, looking at using stories to convey work values. And you're doing something else recently on a website,
mm-hmm.
using video. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
With my colleague Ryan Babineau, we have created a website that you are invited to visit, www.inspiredtowork.com. Inspired to on this we have videos that were made by students in my class and also some videos made elsewhere, some in Canada, about occupations, and basically the students were put in teams of three and invited to interview somebody who was employed in an occupation to make a video and to edit it down to a very short, maybe 10 or 20 minutes at most, sort of seeing what this person was doing on the job, watching them work, talking to them about what they did and how they liked it and what they didn't like, and, and how they got into it with what it'd be like to work in many different kinds of occupation. It's going to take just a few minutes to find out.
That's a real extension of, isn't it, of your theory, because you're bringing the learning to them.
Well, making the learning available to them, but they have to go get it.
Sure.
They have to get on the internet and type in inspiredtowork.com.
Yep.
They have to do something in order to get exposed to this particular kind of learning.
I think that's a great idea. As we were saying before we started the interview, it's a bit like a sort of YouTube for careers.
It is. It's YouTube for careers. That's what it is.
I think that's a great idea. And while we're talking about that notion of career education, on the unplanned events side of things, but it struck me that this message may not be as readily consumed in organisations where we've got this traditional sort of command and control sort of management model going on. What are your experiences?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Jim. When I talk to people in organizations or career counselor groups, I usually begin something like this. I say, first of all, think of the title that you have now in the work that you are doing. What is your title? 18 years old. What was your plan at age 18 as to what you thought you wanted to be when you were an adult? Okay? Now, how many of you find that you are now doing exactly what you thought you would do when you were 18? And usually, the answer is about 0%. Sometimes 1 or 10 and say, well, I wanted to work with people when I was 18, and I'm working with people now. And then I would say, tell me a job that you can do where you don't have to work with people. There is no such job. I mean, every job involves working with people at some level. So what I say is, here we are. We are career counselors, and I didn't ever plan to be a career counselor when I was 18, and you never planned to be a career counselor when you were 18. Why is it then that we should bring these 18-year-olds to declare a future occupation? We couldn't do it ourselves. Why should we insist that they do it?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing that happens, this mysterious change from being an adolescent to being a parent, and suddenly we become incredibly conservative offspring, and that means absolute certainty. So we want them in that job because then we can kind of say, right, we've done our job.
Which
is another form of making things static again.
Yes, that's right.
But going back to the adolescent issue, because there's the issue of the organisations, and that's a good way of getting people in organisations to appreciate that uncertainty and opportunity awareness is critically important. But if for adolescents, this message is a potentially difficult one to get across, because in a sense what we're saying is take calculated risks. To a group of people who are renowned for reckless behaviour in areas such as driving or drug use or sexual behaviour, hijacked by people who get alarmed that you're sort of taking these people off their sort of predestined course, if you will.
Well, that presupposes that there is a predestined course, and of course I'm saying there is no such thing. but you're right, you see, this notion that you should plan your life in advance has been highly advertised for a century. And people think that that is the way it is supposed to be done. And I know lots of adults that sort of apologize when they say, well, yeah, I am working now as a lab technician, but I never planned to do it. As if not having planned to do it somehow makes the work less valuable.
I think that causes a problem in organisations where people get promoted because they're in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very common experience.
Yes.
But it leads the individual, the incumbent, to feel illegitimate.
That's right. That's right. And there's sort of an imposter syndrome that, you know, I really don't deserve this. I just happen to be in the right place at the right time, and they pick me, but it's not because I deserve it.
And I suspect that that leads on to lots of self-limiting behaviour, that they won't put themselves up for other promotions or any more objective kind of process for fear that they'll be exposed, their secret will be out.
The secret. See, we ought to say, we're all imposters.
Yes.
We are all imposters. We are all faking it. Just join the crowd. Mm. See, I think we ought to publicize it rather than hide it.
Yep, I agree. I agree, absolutely. Okay, I've got a couple more questions for you before we if we can move on to those. And I just wanted to ask you, because you've been aboard of the General Career Assessment and you've mentioned the Career Beliefs Inventory, currently, I think, in the field of career development, there's been a move away from psychometric testing, to the point where you'll hear some people saying proudly, I never use testing as a badge of honour. How do you feel about that sort of... I mean, do you acknowledge that sort
I think that there is a reason for it, which is that if you think that these assessment instruments are to be used in order to match people to a future occupation, then you should avoid them. But if you think that these instruments would be valuable learning stimulants, then I think we should use them. Things like the Strong Interest Inventory and the Career Beliefs Inventory and the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator Personality Tests and other all kinds of tests might be useful. They are useful because they might get people thinking about alternative, and maybe even challenging some of their assumptions, so that they are inclined to think along some different lines than they thought before. So if you think of it as learning instruments, I say let's use them. If you think of them as matching instruments, forget them.
Okay. Yep, that makes a lot of sense to me. And one is really just a comment on a quote. I've already mentioned Peter Ustinov before. And I just thought, I came across this quote that was attributed to him on the occasion of his 75th birthday, and he said, with a with typical irony, I really must decide what to do with my life.
Well, I resonate about my life. I have not yet, I told you about my neurosis, that I never was able to decide what I want to be when I grow up, and I still feel the same way. I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And Jim, make me an offer. Maybe I'll move to Australia and join you.
Well, yeah, that would be good. Or we could Stanford and join you here.
Well, there we go.
You never know what's going to happen.
You never know. Maybe one or both of these events will happen. Maybe we'll just change jobs.
Okay. And finally, John, I'd like to ask you, a personal question about your contribution to the field. And it's in terms of you would feel you'd like to leave in the field of career counselling, career development, career education.
Oh, what legacy would I like to leave? I don't really like to, first place, I don't want to leave. I want to keep making my contribution because it's fun, and I guess what I'd like to say, or I'd like people to believe, is that, you know, life is a fantastic privilege that we have been given. It's a miracle that we are even here at all. And so let's enjoy it. Let's have fun. Let's make what we love. And let's not worry about all the other trivia that we are plagued with, that are foist upon us by these beliefs that are not really true.
John Crumbles, thank you very much for talking to me today.
It's fun talking with you, Jim.
Okay, thanks.
You've been listening to an interview with Professor John Crumbles from Stanford University that I conducted in June 2007. You may have noticed occasional jumps and clicks in the sound recording. I apologize for this, and discovered a technical issue to do with recording interviews on the fly using iPods. That issue has now been resolved by using a bigger capacity iPod, than the one I was using when I was interviewing Professor Crumbolts. I hope, however, that it has not impaired your enjoyment of this interview. Bright & Associates sell a range of instruments that are entirely compatible with Professor Crumbolts' approach to careers. In particular, the Luck Readiness Index measures many of the dimensions that Crumbolts thinks are important in relation to careers. The Luck Readiness Index is a pencil and paper test which is compared to other people and measures people's flexibility, optimism, luckiness, strategy, efficacy, and a range of other luck-related items. The notion is to measure opportunity awareness and flexibility in the face of continually changing circumstances of the sort that Crumbolts was talking about. We also sell creative thinking strategies, a card sort, which again capitalizes on the notion of change and chance, as well as the complexity perception index, another very useful instrument that has been used successfully in a range of different settings in organizations and also with university students through various university career counseling units around Australia. And indeed, there will be a pilot of the LRI and CPI overseas, and more news about that later. If you're interested in any of these products, then go to www.brightandassociates.com.au and follow the links to the shop or card sorts or tests, and you'll find all the relevant information. I can also recommend John Crumbolts' book that he wrote with Al Levin, which is called Luck is No Accident.
That was another Factory podcast brought to you by Bright & Associates. www.brightandassociates.com.au